Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
It's my party.
Our question today is, can the Democratic Party be saved? Recently, the Democratic Unity Reform Commission met in Washington, D.C., and Norman Solomon was there. He is the co-founder of RootsAction.org and a progressive Democrat who's fighting for the future of the party. It was an unusual meeting as the establishment forces tried to shut down messaging by Norman Solomon, almost got him booted out of the room. And there was a dramatic presentation by a young Bernie Sanders representative named Nomiki Konst. There's a lot to talk about related to the future of the party and those dreaded superdelegates. It's all ahead. And this podcast is made possible by people like you who support my work with subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Susan Gavet, Jim Garrison, Terry Paris, and Bill Janetta. Thanks a lot for your support. You know the drill. If you'd like to become a subscriber, just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, and you'll land on the sign-up page in a jiffy. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we explore the question, can the Democratic Party be rescued from corporate forces? Norman Solomon is an activist who attended the Unity Reform Conference last week. We get his report. Activism music from Chicago's Shy Lights, right around 1970. We got to give more power to the people. Norman Solomon has been fighting that fight for a long time. Longtime progressive activist in the Democratic Party. I recall him as an Obama delegate to the 2008 Democratic Convention in Denver. He was a Sanders delegate in 2016. And he is the author, of course, of the seminal book War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And he is a co-founder of RootsAction.org, among many other credits. Norman, always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm glad you're available today because it looked like last weekend you might have been locked up by the security team at the Democratic Unity Forum.
Well, Peter, I'm glad to be with you on this podcast, and I think that being able to speak up is such a wonderful experience that the more we can partake of it, the better.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the origins of the Democratic Unity Reform Commission, because there's been a clear split between the Sanders and Clinton wings of the Democratic Party since the brutal loss last November and the fight over the DNC chair that was won by the more establishment figure, Tom Perez, over Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, has left some wounds but also some divergence about the vision for the future of the party. So what was the design of the Unity Reform Commission, Norman?
I think it was really an effort to look ahead beyond what at that point was the upcoming November 2016 election. At that point, which is to say when the commission was created at the time of the Democratic Convention last year, it was widely believed, of course, that Hillary Clinton would become president. But even then, there was a recognition that, wow, Bernie got around 45% of the delegates. That astonished the power structure. He was believed initially by them, wishful thinking, that he'd just be some sort of fringe single-digit candidate. And so I think there was a recognition, hey, we need to at least take some steps to heal the wounds. And, well, first word of the commission, create unity.
Okay. But the backroom moves in between, where Tom Perez has sacked some of the Sanders supporters and parked some of his allies, including lobbyists and, you know, what I would call corporate Democrats. It hasn't really sent strong signals that actions match the rhetoric.
Peter, I got to say, I've been a bit surprised that Tom Perez has been so vindictive. I don't mean that he's spoken in a vindictive way. It's sort of like he talks nice, and then he gets the knives out. And okay, that's part of politics, but when you are, or can be part of politics, but if the pretense or the assumption or the claim is that you want to create unity, you know, nobody fell off the turnip truck from the Bernie forces. We're going to see what happens. And when, as did happen back in October of this year, there was essentially a purge of the most powerful committees, most of all perhaps the Rules Committee of the Democratic National Committee, then we see that Perez, now 9-10 months into being chair of the Democratic National Committee, is really trying to wipe out the Bernie-aligned progressive forces from the decision-making bodies that are most powerful in the party.
Mm-hmm. And, Norman, when I've heard Tom Perez speak, he's a good spinmeister. I give him credit. He is verbally skilled, and he says a lot of things that sound nice but have no real political calories, in my opinion. And as he, you know, wrestled the DNC chair away from Keith Ellison at the behest of President Obama and the lingering elements of the Clinton machine, I found it extremely uncomfortable. And I feel sad for Keith Ellison today. I've met the man, talked with him on many occasions. I've got high regard for him and for his honesty. But he was kind of... seduced into this unity position as the vice chair. And it often leaves him holding a bag that has Tom Perez's name on it.
I think that Ellison's in a box. Once he decided to step into that job as deputy chair, then he was inside the tent rather than outside. And, you know, that famous... Lyndon Johnson quote.
You can say it on podcast, okay?
Can I? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing here, but he said it's better to have somebody inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
Yep.
And he was talking about neutralizing those who might really polarize and challenge him or his political power. And I think that's approximately what happened. And the Clinton-aligned Perez people thought, wow, we just defeated Ellison in a close elections, as you allude to, Peter. They pulled out all the stops, including intervention from, at that point, former President Obama, to get the job done, but they wanted to smooth it over. And so they created, I don't even know the deputy chair, it even existed, but anyway, they elevated Ellison from loser to second in command. I don't think he's in command of anything.
Yeah.
And so now he's sort of stuck. He can't do anything more than these subtle semi-criticisms or divergences from Perez. And what we're getting is more or less business as usual, except that this unity commission, in recognition of the fact that so much of the party, especially at the base, has moved leftward in the last couple of years, they've got to sort of heal this over from the top to the extent they can get away with it and still keep what they want, which is dominant power.
Mm-hmm. And Norman, this really brings up for me the work and the strategy of our late mutual friend Tim Carpenter, co-founder of the Progressive Democrats of America organization, and the guy who really forged the inside-outside strategy. And from my perspective here, I see you as continuing on that path.
I think there are real challenges and opportunities to have approximately five of your toes inside and the balance of them outside, so that there's a recognition that social movements and protests and just changing the ambience and the culture politically and socially of the society at large as much as you can supplement and have a synergy with being inside the party. And I think we saw through the Bernie Sanders campaign, which Tim Carpenter and Progressive Democrats of America was the first really significant-sized group to encourage Bernie to consider running for president and calling for him to do it a few years ago. That approach does have some payoff, and it's a challenge in part, and I say this only somewhat in jest, you're up against, if you decide to do inside-the-party work, to one of the great tactics of the corporate party establishment. They try to bore you to death. You end up in these endless meetings, or they seem endless. And yet, if you persevere, you have this capacity to bring the power of the grassroots into the party where the people in control don't want it. And you can make a real impact.
Mm-hmm. You do have to be invited, and actually, when you RSVP, they have to give you the location of the meeting, though, right, Norm?
A minor detail, yes. It's hard to separate sometimes incompetence from just manipulative dishonesty. And frankly, from the top of the DNC, the Perez administration, there seems to be quite a bit of both. In the case of this Unity Reform Commission, I was calling almost daily early this month the press person I had a card from to find out, when is the meeting? What room is the meeting in? We only had a one-week notice as to the name of the hotel, and it's a huge one, Marriott Wardman.
Mm-hmm.
And then we only found out a couple of days before the meeting what time it would take place. So how do you publicize and get a turnout to a meeting where you can't tell people it's in the morning, the afternoon, the evening, and so forth? And so when finally there was a notice put out, not very widely, mostly in a news release, with a link for people to sign up as members of the public, then the people who signed up, RSVP'd, never got any notice back. And that is just, at best it's incompetence, but I don't think it's only that. I think it's a calculated, dishonest, manipulative way to claim to be holding a public meeting and suppress the turnout of the public. And I think it's obvious why. Because commission, the party, is controlled by people who don't want to hear from the grassroots.
And those who know, know.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to engage in a struggle in 2018 between the top of the Democrat National Committee and the progressive grassroots. And we're going to move now to the phase of what they call the Rules and Bylaws Committee, which takes these recommendations and votes on them, and then the full DNC will vote before the end of next year. It might sound a little arcane or inside baseball, but question is, will the people who vote as delegates to choose the nominee of the next presidential candidate of the Democratic Party, will they all be responsive to and reflecting the views and ballots cast by voters, or will hundreds and hundreds of them, including the ones who first get to declare their public preferences, be superdelegates who are lobbyists, who are elitists, who are not chosen for that purpose at all?
Well, and Norman, for me, when I hear all of this exaggerated talk about how Russia meddled and Russia tipped the election to Trump, I start with the undemocratic nature of the superdelegates. And as you point out in the autopsy report that you co-authored with three other progressive Democrats, the superdelegates were committed to Hillary Clinton mostly before Bernie Sanders even surfaced as a significant factor in the primaries. And so for them to remain locked down when Bernie, as you pointed out earlier, generated 45% of the so-called pledged delegates earned through caucuses and primaries, he was within reach of winning the nomination if there had been a contested convention and if the superdelegates had been released or had released themselves. We might have had a very, very different outcome.
The fact that 15% of the delegates were these unaccountable superdelegates even understates the problem, because it was as though in a race the starting gun goes off and half a second later one of the race participants is way ahead of the other. And that's what happened 11 weeks before a single primary or caucus ballot was cast in the 2016 race. I'm talking Iowa, New Hampshire, anywhere. There were already hundreds and hundreds, just half of the 712 superdelegates had already declared for Hillary Clinton. And what that does, among other things, is immediately in the media, she's the front runner. The fundraising ways to set up a Rube Goldberg way to funnel money from state parties to national parties, ostensibly back to the state parties, but ends up helping Hillary Clinton. All the ways that was jerry-rigged was manipulated so that at the very beginning, before anybody had any voice heard from what's supposed to be a democracy, it was already hot-wired to put one candidate way ahead. And that's simply wrong, and that's what we're trying to stop for 2020.
Norman Solomon with me here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. Norman, I want to get more details about this meeting and some of the little incidents that occurred. But as I look at this and I watch some of the video on Facebook, I'm grateful to you and your small team that helped get the information out. But I kept asking myself, where's Bernie? And throughout this whole process of, forensically looking at the 2016 election, Bernie, has this whole MO where he's always looking forward and doesn't like to get bogged down in disputes that relate to the past. But this really is critical to the future of the Democratic Party, whether Bernie runs in 2020 or not. And I really believe that his voice is missing. And when Donna Brazile published segments of her book and the term rigged was put into play, Sanders basically demurred on all of the invitations for him to comment on how unfair the process was and how the party struggles to deal with that, as you have been describing here today. And so it does burn me a little bit that Senator Sanders is not a part of this debate.
Well, we use a metaphor at the beginning of the autopsy report. And by the way, this is a totally independent report called Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. People can look at it, the executive summary of the whole thing, at democraticautopsy.org on the web. We use the train wreck metaphor, which is not unfounded when you look at what happened in November 2016. My God, when you have a President Donald Trump as a result, train wreck is an understatement. So after train wreck, investigators come in, and they talk about what could have and should have been done differently to prevent that catastrophe from taking place. And so talking about the past is essential if you're going to prevent something like it from occurring in the future, and that's why we did the autopsy. I think given that because of the election to the chair of the Democratic National Committee of this Clintonoid person, who is now exercising that very large amount of power, Tom Perez, he had the swing vote appointments, so that out of 21 members of this unity commission that has now made recommendations, only 8 were appointed by Bernie, 8 were appointed by Clinton, and 3 by Perez, who, by my source accounts, chose people who were even more corporate than Clinton. So, long story short, it was an outnumbered situation where there were several more corporate people on the commission than the Bernie-appointed folks. But those eight people were very outspoken, whether it's Gus Newport, the former mayor of Berkeley, whether it's the vice chair of the commission, Larry Cohen. There were a number of people who were just so articulate, including perhaps the best known among progressives, Nina Turner, mm-hmm. Former state senator from Ohio. And they really pushed, and they really tactically created an atmosphere of contention based on issues. And I think that what Bernie Sanders was viewing this as was that he had appointed these eight folks, and they gave voice to a progressive struggle to move the party through the commission in a better direction. So, yes, Bernie could have trashed the DNC publicly. He certainly has done it in various ways. He did give a New York Times Magazine reporter what I think is one of the great quotes of our era about 7-8 months ago. He said, "There are people in the Democratic Party who don't mind being on the Titanic as long as they have a first-class cabin." And that does describe, you know, what we're up against.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So there is a video that at least went viral in my little Facebook world of Norman Solomon holding a sign, not a huge one, that I believe said democracy or undemocracy. Is that right?
Well, it said Democratic Party or Undemocratic Party.
There we go. Yeah. And then the video shows you kind of dancing a little bit as you address the chair of the Unity Reform Commission, and it appears that she has already called a couple of security guards to try to remove your sign and perhaps remove Norman Solomon from the room. Describe that episode for our listeners.
There were rules posted that included no outside signs allowed, whatever that means. I don't believe that the Democratic National Committee rules should supersede the First Amendment of the Constitution. And at rootsaction.org, we organized not only the autopsy report that, as I mentioned, is fully titled Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, but we also organized very small group that included three of the authors of the autopsy, myself and Karen Bernal, the chair of the California Democratic Party's Progressive Caucus, and Pia Gallegos, who's a civil rights attorney based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So we attended this meeting, and it took some detective work in a way to even know when and where it was taking place. But we were there, and we brought signs. And we thought that was the most poignant, or at least to the point, sign that we could think of, Democratic Party or Undemocratic Party, ? So we brought the signs into the room, and at an opportune moment, I simply stood up and walked towards one side of the room next to the edge of the table where the commission members were seated during the meeting, and I held it, and really, Peter, I was surprised how quickly I was accosted by, they almost seemed to swing down from the ceiling, I didn't even see them coming, two or three rent-a-cops. And one of them just grabbed the sign, and you would not think it was such a threat to the order of civilization to hold up that sign. I just was so amazed. I mean, it might be in part because C-SPAN was broadcasting it live, but still, I thought it was just out of proportion. And someone else sitting in the front row then stood up, who I didn't know, but had introduced himself to me earlier in the day. And he said his sign, well, I guess apparently he brought his own, had been confiscated from him before he went into the room. Now, maybe because I had my signs in a big backpack and had just sort of brought them in, that's why mine weren't confiscated. Maybe because I had a suit and tie on and he didn't. Who knows what the silly reason was. But he also had that experience. So I think it was so embarrassing to the commission members, and including the chair, that the rule was suddenly rescinded, and okay, if you sit down, you can hold the sign. So that was sort of episode one of what you might say were three or four interventions that we implemented during the two-day commission meeting.
Well, Norman, I'm going to award you the Medea Benjamin Award for, ad-libbed comments as you were threatened with expulsion from a room.
Well, I consider that an honor. Because I could never be as deft as Medea Benjamin at finding ways to get into places where my voice should be heard. But she is somebody I, of course, greatly admire as a progressive activist.
Well, and just while I'm talking about it, that incident with President Obama, where she managed to plant herself so deeply into the room that her removal took about a minute and a half, and she did not stop her tirade, and it was brilliant. I mean, she was very much on point, and it made Obama respond to her, and he acted as if he'd never heard of Medea Benjamin.
Well, it's so remarkable that the Democratic Party culture, especially when Republicans are in power, is from the top to applaud protest when, there's going to be protests against some awful Republican law that's been proposed, of which there have been so many, unfortunately, in the last year. People who lead the Democratic Party, they love it. They applaud sit-ins at the Republican congressional offices. But when we protest the Democratic Party hierarchy, then there's cognitive dissonance. And I actually think that's what was taking place at that moment when my illicit sign was held up.
But they didn't bring in the white noise machines or the other spook tools that were used at the convention last summer to silence people?
Not this time. I think they were sort of not expecting such. And just to sort of give the sequence, at the end of that day, Pia Gallegos and I held up a 6-foot banner, and fortunately, C-SPAN was still rolling. So we had a couple of minutes of our banner saying the same thing, Democratic Party or Undemocratic Party, hastened to add, like the sign with a union bug on it. And we held it up for the national audience, which was good. And then the next morning, when we waited for the commission to get out of their private meeting, I put an executive summary on the desk in front of all 21 commission members. And then about 20 minutes later, a DNC staff person noticed it, took them all up, put them in a side table, and then one of my colleagues grabbed those and a few minutes later replaced them all. And then a member of the commission who noticed it, a Clinton-aligned member from Maryland, again took them up and took them away. And then I grabbed them because I didn't want them to be recycled. And the sort of the finale, as far as I was concerned, is as the commission members sat down, while C-SPAN's cameras were rolling, Karen Bernal stood up and addressed them with a 2.5-minute soliloquy, which reached the national audience and basically bawled out the commission leadership for keeping the public out, for being so petty and scared of concepts that our executive summary, the autopsy, couldn't be left on the tables in front of the commission members. And again, I think because Karen was so forthright, it embarrassed the commission members, and the chair of the commission said, it must be a misunderstanding, let's replace the executive summary. These are all, I think, as much as anything else, metaphors for something that we point out in the autopsy.
And Norman, in an article that you published at Consortium News, and I think it was also at Common Dreams, perhaps elsewhere, you quoted Karen Bernal as part of that soliloquy saying, "For all the talk about wanting to improve and reform and make this party more transparent, the exact opposite has happened." And let me ask a basic question. Do you have any indication that any of the members of the commission who weren't appointed by Bernie Sanders actually read the autopsy, if only the executive summary?
Well, when Karen making her statement, I heard one of the Clinton-appointed, or Perez-appointed, because they were never differentiated, I believe it was James Roosevelt on the commission blurting out that he had read the autopsy's executive summary. And I think it's gotten around enough. You know, it was the cover story in The Nation magazine and so forth. I think they've read it, but I don't think they like it, most of the commission members. And, of course, now they're history. The commission is basically disbanded. One of the ironies that strikes me is that, you know, if you're holding a sign that asks the question, Democratic Party or Undemocratic Party, and the sign is ruled inadmissible, that is a step towards sort of answering the question. And also, one of the main quotes that we highlight in the executive summary from the autopsy report is that the leadership of a party cannot bond with the base of the party when the leadership of the party is afraid of the base of the party. And I think what happened at the commission meeting is just another of numerous cases in point. I think that's really true, Peter. I think that the leadership of the party, including Chair Tom Perez, is frightened of the base. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a tacit division of labor in their conception. Young people, people of color, the working class, they must turn out to vote. They must be cajoled and encouraged to vote, sometimes guilt-tripped into voting. But the limits, the constraints on the party must be adhered to from Wall Street and the donor class, the big check people who can write five- and six-figure checks. And that is their conception of how to run the party.
And Norman, on the Monday after your meeting, the New York Times published an op-ed that could have been ghosted by Tom Perez. It's attributed to Julia Azari, associate professor of political science at Marquette, and Seth Maskett, professor of poli-sci at University of Denver. And in a condescending, paternalistic tone, the headline reads here, "Is the Democratic Party becoming too democratic?" And they actually make the argument that the leaders of the party are best positioned to decide what is best for the party. And they blow right past the corruption that is caused by the influence of lobbyists, of the highly paid DNC consultants who now populate some of these committees, like the Rule Committee of the DNC. They ignore a lot as they, and let me quote here, "Part of the problem for parties is our insistence that they be run democratically. That turns out not to be a very realistic concept. Yes, we can hold elections within parties, but party leaders will always have vastly more information about candidates, their strengths and flaws, their ability to govern and work with Congress, their backing among various interest groups and coalitions, than voters and caucus-goers do. That information is useful, even vital, to the task of picking a good nominee." Wow. I mean, I was floored when I read this, Norman.
Yeah, I think it's candor. It's really what a lot of folks at the top of the party do believe, but they're not usually so blunt. They dance around it, and then they stick in the knives when they think they need to thwart efforts to democratize the party. I believe they have to be drag-kicking and screaming to move in a democratic lowercase d direction. But it's both fatuous and dangerous, this kind of line that the New York Times gave so much space to, and frankly probably reflects a lot of the viewpoint of the editorial board of the New York Times. After all, they couldn't stand Bernie Sanders. They loved Hillary Clinton editorially. There's no regular columnist of the New York Times that supported Bernie. Mm-hmm. There was tremendous support for Hillary Clinton in the primary battle. And then when you think back, I mean, who were the Democratic presidential candidates who were selected by these wise, all-knowing insiders who were being praised by, in that op-ed? Well, let's see. We had Dukakis. We had John Kerry. Mm-hmm. We had Hillary Clinton. These did not pan out so well. It's true that you also got Bill Clinton, who was had the oil put on his head by some of the party insiders. But for the most part, after all, Democratic nominees have lost a lot of presidential elections in our lifetime, and they, virtually without exception, have been anointed by those insiders we're told are so wise.
Yeah. Norman, let me put it this way. The autopsy covers a whole lot of ground, And the critical parts to me include the superdelegates, which we've talked about, but also what I consider to be the way the Clinton campaign took control of the DNC with the complicity of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and then basically bulldozed Donna Brazile when she was installed to replace the discredited Wasserman Schultz. But I believe that there may have been actual crimes committed related to unlawful money transfers. And I take, for example, the case of the George Clooney dinner, and there were many of them, where they were able to pony up as much as $350,000 per couple. And the money was supposed to be split with state party entities, and really only a small portion of that was supposed to go directly to the coffers of the Clinton campaign. But the DNC was sharing a treasurer with the Clinton campaign, and the money that was raised at the state level was sucked up into the accounts in Washington, often the day after an event was held. And I believe, and Bernie filed a lawsuit about this before the primary was over, that there were indications that some of this money that was not supposed to be used during the primary was actually used to fund digital advertising in favor of Hillary Clinton during the primary cycle. And I think this is a very serious issue, and I'd like to know how seriously the Unity Reform Commission took it, in your view.
Oh, I don't think that was dealt with. To my knowledge, it wasn't dealt with. Donna Brazile's excerpt on this topic that appeared on November 2nd, as I remember, of this year, excerpt from her book, really blew this open. And yet there was a lot of reporting here and there on aspects of this, even in real time, or certainly before the November election last year. Our autopsy was released 3 days before Brazile's article came out, and the autopsy has a whole section called Democracy in the Party, written by the civil rights attorney I mentioned, Pia Gallegos, and it goes into it. Not, you know, I say that Donna Brazile had gory details in her account, but our section of the autopsy on this subject details a fair number of the cuts against democracy that was involved here. And as you say, it was very, very shady, very shady. And this is, in a way, the most disturbing part in the present time, or one of them, on this aspect. After the uproar from Donna Brazile's book, Tom Perez issued a statement, and he, in two paragraphs, he first pledged to be even-handed, which is sort of a throwaway platitude, and in the second paragraph, he seemed to be defending the very arrangement that you just described. And he talked about how, you know, all the candidates had access. It was sort of the same cover story that was used at the time. I just don't think that Perez, as chair of the party, has owned up to how improper and wrong so much of what the DNC did last year really was.
Well, I want to play a clip right now by that came from the Unity Reform Conference, and it's one of the Sanders-appointed commission members, Nomiki Konst. Is it Konst or Konst?
You got me. I don't know.
Okay. We'll call her Nomiki. She is well-known to many people. I had to look her up as someone who's acted in movies, and she's appeared on the Fox News Channel. But she really ripped in to the establishment members of the DNC. Let's listen.
This smells. This doesn't just smell to the public right now that the budget of the party was never put before. Forget about the budgetary committee for a second. Put before the people who have a fiduciary responsibility, whether it's Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, whether it's Donna Brazile when she was chair, when she was vice chair, or Vice Chair Ray Buckley, or Dr. Jim Zogby over here. That's over half the executive committee right there had no idea where the money was going. We spent $1 billion, lost the easiest presidential race you could possibly imagine, with joint fundraising agreements. State parties weren't being funded. During the DNC chairs race, there were some state party chairs who said, I'm an acting executive director and I have $3,000 cash on hand. How are you supposed to rebuild the party if you have no idea where that money was spent? And you know what? I did go through FEC filings. And it doesn't look good. It smells. We're talking about close to $700 to $800 million between the joint fundraising agreement and the DNC being spent on five consultants.
Uh-oh.
This is not a public outrage issue. The DNC chairs are upset, the officers are upset, and I don't know who's on the budget and finance committee. I did go to the meeting. It was 15 minutes long, and there was a pie chart that was put on screen.
Yeah.
But I would, as a Democratic Party member of this commission, we have a duty, and people are watching us right now. The number one issue I get asked out in the public by DNC members is, what are you going to do about the budget?
What are you going to do about the budget? So I think that was a very, very powerful indictment. And I'd like to know what the reaction was in the room, Norman.
Well, there was a lot of tension. I think it was one of the high points of the two-day meeting. There were two amendments that Nomiki introduced that were explicitly aimed at countering conflicts of interest, and they were both defeated, and they were supported by the Bernie appointees, and they were opposed by the Clinton and Perez appointees. And an irony is that Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, the chair of the Unity Reform Commission, who was appointed by the Clinton Perez forces, she herself, in a 4-month period last year during the primary season, received $230,000. Two Precision Strategies, which she co-founded, it was her firm, and she therefore was holding the gavel during a meeting that was discussing whether to implement stringent conflict of interest measures for the DNC. I think that tells us just how deep this goes. People are getting their incomes, lavish incomes, from the status quo. And they're not inclined to sign that away.
Nomiki is right. It stinks. It certainly does. So let me quote again from the summary that you wrote about this, Norman. Overall, the commission approved some recommendations that were partial victories for progressives. Among the most notable, it called for reducing the number of notoriously undemocratic superdelegates to the national convention from 712 to about 300, while the only Democratic number would be zero. You go on to say that they also, took a few other actions, but these are now subject to approval by the full Democratic National Committee. And it's hard to imagine that the superdelegates who populate, many of these are the same people who are either members or officers of the DNC, it's hard to believe that they will vote against their self-interest.
Yeah, that's why while RootsAction.org and other groups are going to fight to reduce the number of superdelegates to zero, the greater likelihood is that the gains we've made will actually be rolled back, at least in part, for the reason you describe. What are the chances that DNC members are going to want to deprive themselves of superdelegate status? The recommendation from this commission is that they might have the honorific name of delegates, but they won't have the autonomy on their own say-so to decide they're going to vote for X, Y, or Z candidate to be nominated by the party for president just because they want to. They would have to cast a vote in proportion to the balloting in their states or their district. And so that's why I think we have a huge fight on our hands. And even though this might seem to be in the weeds, in fact, a couple of years from now, these factors could determine who is going to be running for president as a Democrat in November 2020.
Yeah. And Norman, you and I are in the same congressional district. Our congressman is Jared Huffman. I will note that you ran against him when the seat was open in 2010. And, overall, I think that Jared has operated, slightly left of center and doesn't always take commands from the Pelosi leadership. But he has been steadfast in defense and defensiveness about his refusal to vote the will of the district And he did cast his superdelegate vote for Hillary Clinton last year. When I last spoke with him, which was on election night, it was a little after the election. He was poo-pooing it, saying, you know, well, let's not reopen old issues.
I said, yeah, right.
But Jared, you need to understand, from my perspective, it's the superdelegate's fault that Trump is president. And, you know, he found that to be a low blow. But I frankly think it's just candor.
I think it's accurate, especially because it's not just numerical. If you look at the advantage, the momentum, the front-runner status, the access to money, and all the rest of it, that early pledges as a superdelegate to support Clinton, all the impact that that had, it was tremendously important. And it was really before the campaign and during the campaign and after the election. At every stage, there were people living in this district who said, Jared, why are you promising to be a superdelegate voting for Clinton? Nobody in your district has even voted yet. And then after the election, Congressional District 2 in California, Bernie won by a margin of 6 or 7%.
Yeah.
And yet steadfastly, Jared refused to change his vote beforehand or acknowledge it was wrong afterwards. And I think, frankly, a big reason, and this was true across the country, is that people like to align with a winner. And he felt that if he was a Clinton superdelegate, and then, as expected, we had a President Hillary Clinton, she would smile upon him, he would get all sorts of perks and benefits, who knows what those benefits might have entailed. And the other hand, if he had had the courage that very few members of the House had, only Keith Ellison, only Raul Grijalva from Arizona, only a very few in the House, only
Jeff Merkley from Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if Jared had uncharacteristically had that courage, then he might have been in a doghouse with a Hillary Clinton White House. And I think that explains a lot of the power dynamics across the board.
Well, two friendly amendments. One is your doghouse metaphor is a little bit too nice because the vindictiveness of the Clintons is something that is well known.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add is that using Jared Huffman just as an example of superdelegate strength, one of the real ugly moves was that based on a poll of the superdelegates and the progress to date on pledged delegates, the Associated Press made an announcement the night before the California primary saying that Hillary had locked it up.
Yeah.
And you know, there were also problems because there were a lot of new voters who didn't understand the top two primary, and that the Democratic primary was open, but the Republican wasn't. And so there was confusion among many voters. But the net effect was that I believe Bernie might have won California if it hadn't been for that ill-timed prediction that came from the AP the night before.
Yeah, it's another dynamic of just the corrosive effects involved. And when you look at the rationales, of course, somebody in office who doesn't want to buck the prevailing power structure, they always have rationales. They never say, look, I want to rise. I want to look good to the leadership of the party. I want to advance myself. No politician in my memory has ever said, well, look, I'm an opportunist in this instance. But what we did hear was stuff like, and we heard this from Congressman Jared Huffman and quite a few others before the nominating convention. They said, I think that Hillary Clinton is a stronger candidate to defeat Donald Trump. And it wouldn't matter how many polls were shown or whatever that Bernie was a stronger candidate against Trump. They just held to that. It sort of goes to the earlier part of our discussion, Peter, about this claim that, oh, leave it to the party insiders. They're the smart ones. They're at the top. They're the savvy ones who will know. And we've seen how, well, again, that panned out in this instance. What I was saying at the time, and I said this publicly and was quoted as such in the context of what Jared Huffman was contending, was, look, nobody has a real crystal ball. These polls are indicating that Bernie would be a stronger candidate. Nobody knows for sure, but since nobody knows for sure, why don't we support the best candidate who's a genuine progressive?
Well, that's pretty novel, Norman.
What a concept.
So I want to recommend that people take a look at the autopsy report. I'm going to link to it in the show file for this podcast, along with the Norman Solomon piece that was at Consortium News and the condescending edit op-ed from the New York Times. And I encourage you to spend as much time as you can find to study these materials. And Norman, as we wrap up, there's so much in the autopsy, but I want to single out one thing in your recommendations that really resonated with me. And that is, you and your colleagues write, social movements cannot be understood as tools to get Democrats elected. And this really pushes a button for me, because there is a presence on Facebook and other social media called Occupy Democrats. And there was a concerted effort to take the momentum and the power of the leaderless Occupy movement, which did an amazing job of addressing and helping really get people's attention about both wealth and income inequality. And they tried to, subsume that into the Democratic Party and fool people with, by using a similar name and by promoting similar themes, but not nearly as deep or as likely to change. Just nice compromise positions that make good talking points for a centrist Democratic candidate. And so I want to single that out for praise, because I think that the Democratic leaders fool themselves when they think that they can put out something like Occupy Democrats or a parallel movement to Black Lives Matter and find, be taken credibly or perceived credibly by the average progressive voter.
I think that's a key point. It's very hard for politicians, but it's necessary. It's hard for them to recognize that social movements are not in existence to be subsets of their political election campaigns. Quite the opposite. Any political campaign to elect anybody should be part of something much more profound, wider, and deeper, social movements that really can create the kind of changes that can create a more humanistic society.
Well, Norman, I want to thank you first for joining me today, but also for your ongoing efforts and actions to try to reform politics in this country. And I really applaud your dedication to the Democratic Party. I think you know that I gave up on it a long time ago. I briefly re-registered as a Democrat so I could vote for you and a few others as delegates to the convention for Bernie. And 2 days later, I re-registered as an independent, no party preference. So I appreciate that you continue to fight for your vision of a progressive Democratic Party. And I salute you and Karen Bernal and Sam McCann and also Pia Gallegos for your hard work on the autopsy for the Democratic Party.
Well, Peter, thanks for your wonderful ongoing work on radio, your podcast, and we'll all keep on keeping on.
All right. Norman Solomon, always a pleasure. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth conversation with Norman Solomon. Send me your feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails.